water, earth, fire, air. Months ago, all of us could come and go as we pleased in harmony. Then everything changed when the pandemic attacked. Only the TV series Avatar, The Last Airbender, a series our friends kept telling us about, would stop us from anxiously watching the news. But just when we needed to stream it most, it vanished.
About a year has passed since my cousin and I started podcasting about Avatar, and although we've all been through a lot in this past year, we believed Aang could save the world. And you know what? We were right. After ending the 100-year war, with the help of their friends, Avatar Aang and Fire Lord Zuko transformed the Fire Nation colonies into the United Republic of Nations, a society where benders and non-benders from all over the world could live and thrive in peace and harmony. They named the capital of this great land Republic City. Avatar Aang accomplished many remarkable things in his life, but sadly, his time in the world came to an end. And like the cycle of the seasons, the cycle of the Avatar began anew. This is Kin Folklore, Avatar, the Legend of Korra.
People of Republic City, welcome to Kin Folklore. We're back to explore the world of Avatar by delving into the complexities of its sequel, The Legend of Korra. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and we're cousins who podcast about our favorite fantasy and sci-fi television shows. After concluding our coverage of Avatar The Last Airbender, we decided to continue exploring the world of bending by first covering the comics and now following the journey of Avatar Korra as she navigates the post-war world.
Last week, Opal Lin and Bolin broke the Beifong family out of one of Kuvira's prisons with the help of Toph and saved Zhuli from certain death. They also found the massive destruction that the Spirit Vine weapon can cause. Korra returned to Republic City, reunited with her friends. She also faced Zaheer so that she could finally make peace with what happened between them. This week, we are concluding our epic journey with Avatar Korra as she faces off with Kuvira to save Republic City in episodes 11 through 13 of Book 4, Balance.
You know, in honor of this being the last episode of Legend of Korra, I was actually thinking about no adult content today altogether.
Are you serious?
For once, I am. You're going to say I'm being lazy, I'm afraid of responsibility, I'm putting my singing career before the podcast, but it's none of those things. I really do wonder how we've managed to do adult content on a Nickelodeon cartoon for two freaking series. It's been two. But I really do think that if we want to maintain our health and we don't want the people who elected us as the leaders to treat them like the United Republic leadership would, I better keep it. I'll keep it for today. Just for today. In the last episode of this season, you will now have the crude jokes on call and everything that you've come to love it. You'll have it. Adult content on deck. Let's go.
Oof. Okay, that was scary. I was like, we didn't discuss this.
I was inspired by Wu. Wu was like out here bringing down the monarchy, so I was inspired.
Episode 11, Kuvira's Gambit, begins with Kuvira addressing her followers. Very chilling. Big Daenerys Targaryen in King's Landing vibes. Just vibing.
We are going to bomb everything and destroy it all. All my Earth Kingdom. Oh yeah, she was in her full Daenerys bag.
Or maybe it was more like Lee and Lo announcing the return of Azula and Zuko.
Miss Lee and Lo! Oh my
they
gosh!
So good.
The original iconic duo. Oh, it's so good.
So she tells them that the United Republic is on stolen land that Avatar Aang and Zuko took from the people of the Earth Kingdom.
What? This brings us back full circle to where we started with the comics and all the work that happened. This is why I like this episode, this stuff a lot in these last stretch of episodes, is this carries in a lot of stuff. But what a crazy take that, hey, you stole the land. You're going all the way back to the Earth King days. Like, you're going back to the first battle in the Promise. Wow, crazy.
Listen, she's not entirely wrong, but the land was given, not taken.
Exactly.
Well, actually, not really. If we really think about this, this was land that was colonized. And then rather than returning it, they created something new. Maybe, you know, she has a right to her opinion. Her speech is still crazy.
How do we even know, though? Because the records of the person who did the real negotiation have been lost forever because he was a steak dinner. Like, Bosco was sitting at the negotiating table and he is now gone. It's terrible. He was eaten.
Oh,
may he rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Bosco. So in Republic City, they're getting ready. Tenzin, Korra, Mako, Wu, and Raiko are having a strategy session, and the evacuation is not going well, mainly because it's voluntary and families don't want to leave. They've only evacuated 18 families.
Yeah, and they feel no pressure to evacuate because they don't feel any imminent danger. They're like, yeah, there's nothing happening. Like, why are you guys telling us to leave our homes? I feel them. They should have made it mandatory and made the threat more, like, made them understand, like, what was happening, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I thought through this. Why, like, if it were me, where are they resettling you? You're uprooting your whole life. Like, it's a lot to ask people to evacuate.
Agreed.
Bolin busts into the meeting with Sue, Julie, and Lin, and tells them about the weapon. Julie tells them that the plan is to attack Republic City in 2 weeks. They decide to cut the rail lines once they finish the evacuation, which is now going to be mandatory. Varric is hard at work on these flying mecha tanks that he and Asami have developed. They're called hummingbirds. When Bolin arrives with Julie, Julie gives this very beautiful speech about what she did and why she did it. And she ends it by telling him that he means the world to her. And Varric is like, great, thanks. Anyway, can you man the assembly line?
What? First of all, why is Julie apologizing at all? Like, she should just explain why she did what she did.
I think she's apologizing for reading him for filth.
Yeah, that was true. That is true. She did.
But, definitely read him for filth.
But was she wrong, though?
No. Everything she said was true. There was exactly. Not one lie. There was not one lie.
Oh, God. So, I mean, I get it. She's trying to piece it out. But then he's just like, exactly what she doesn't want. Like, yeah, let me treat you like an assistant. She's like, yo, I'm not your assistant anymore. I'm coming back, and you're going to treat me as an equal or just get out of here. I'm with her.
Yeah, I loved her response because the old Julie would have been like, okay, but she's just like, nah, I'm not doing this with you again.
Yeah, 100%.
So Mako jumps on the radio and starts to give very detailed directions about the evacuation I was triggered by this. This felt like CDC guidance to me. Like, it was very triggering. I'm not clear what he's saying. Go to quadrant 4 if you live in this neighborhood. So it felt very triggering to me.
Yeah.
And the phone lines light up because now everybody is suddenly shook and they're unclear about what's happening. So Wu takes over. He gets on the radio and gives this ridiculous speech, but it's at least inspiring. The people listen and start to evacuate.
He says, I know you're scared. I'd be scared too. In fact, I'm scared of most things. But you know what? This is what we got to do. It's mandatory. Instead of giving you all the places where you need to go, just go to your nearest place. That was the key. Is he goes, just go to your nearest place. Whatever your nearest train station is, go there and we'll help you get where you need to go.
Yeah. I mean, this obviously makes more sense than Mako's, like, if you live in this district, please report to this person.
Oh my God.
So people start to move more quickly. Preparations are also underway on Air Temple Island, where Tenzin's family is about to be evacuated, but they all agreed to stay. Tenzin suggests that Pema help with the evacuation, and the kids are assigned to help the other airbenders defend the city. Mm. Over the next few days, General Iroh comes with the military. Raiko moves to Air Temple Island for his base of operations. And Korra tells Tenzin, Lin, and Raiko that she, Asami, Bolin, and Mako, Team Avatar, want to go behind the enemy lines and try to take out the super weapon in advance.
And Tenzin's like, I don't know. It could be dangerous. And Raiko's like, sure, send them. Get them out of here. Go. Go do it. Please. Whatever you want to do. Like,
it's a good plan. I actually really liked that they had this moment, even though it doesn't really amount to much.
Yeah.
Because it is sort of a callback to the original when they all first came together and they kind of just took things into their own hands.
Agreed.
I like this moment a lot. It's too late for this because Kuvera is already there. She's a week ahead of schedule. She takes out an outpost with the super weapon, which has been fashioned to a giant mecha suit.
Oh my God.
Big surprise. No one saw this one coming.
Which is where all the dome material went.
Yep. Kuvera had use for all of the metal she took from the domes.
Yep.
So she controls this mecha tank from inside of it. So she's basically in control of this giant mecha tank and also of the super weapon.
And how she's in control of it is it's like augmented reality meets Nintendo Wii. Like she's just like she's just like fucking moving, and she's moving around her arms, and her arms move, and her legs move. It's like, wow, this is crazy.
Oculus Rift, she's pulling. She's pulling the levers, which are metal, using bending, and she can feel through the suit somewhat because it's also metal. But what's a little confusing is the outer part of the suit is platinum.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she can feel the inside of the suit, but not necessarily outside of the suit, which I think is a little bit of a plot hole later on.
Yeah.
They return to... So Team Avatar returns to Air Temple Island to warn everyone. Korra goes to assist Iroh, who's right outside the city, and the others get in place to play their parts. When Kuvera arrives, she takes out the United Republic Navy first, and then takes aim at the ground troops. She tells the president to surrender, or she will wipe out his entire army. And Raiko reluctantly agrees. He doesn't really know. What is he supposed to do? She's a week early. She has this giant mecha tank. She's got a super weapon. I think it's reasonable that he surrenders.
I agree. I think in this moment, like, I think what wasn't reasonable is that they were aware that Kuvera made this plan for 2 weeks. They were also aware that Julie knew and that Kuvera knew that Julie got out of camp. So you would think, as a strategist, that you got to split the difference and be ready a week early because of the fact that if she's coming in 2 weeks, you don't want to push it up to the deadline. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I totally agree. They must have known that she would know that Julie defected and has the information. So even if she can't, you know, it's going to take her a while to get herself together, so she might not be able to push it up super quickly, but you gotta assume she's coming for you early. Like, the notion that she's coming on time is a little bit silly.
Any sort of strategist in worth their salt would not do the same exact plan of somebody who knew the plan that defected, and definitely wouldn't come in a way that you would be expecting. So these are two things that I think many times, a lot of the people in these shows, they just seem so surprised. You know, it takes me back to, you know, here we go again, Game of Thrones. Like, people being surprised when the freaking wall comes down with the freaking dragon. It's like, wait, what were you guys doing all that time when you should have been prepping, right? Like, you knew the Night King was on his way. You knew the dragon was coming. Same thing with this. And this has happened in this show, too. You know, multiple times.
Yeah. I think they got a little caught flat-footed. And honestly, there's a lot of debate in this episode about should they just leave the city. And I actually think that would have been their best tactical advantage, would be to leave the city abandoned the way that Ozai essentially evacuated the capital during the Black Sun. Right? Like, get people out, and then you can attack, you know, with an advantage of the surprise. But it is what it is. This is what they did.
Yeah, that's actually a very smart tactical decision. Like, everybody leaves, you surround the city so that she doesn't know, and then when she comes in looking to fight, it's like it's more by ambush than coming exactly where you already know people are. But the only concern I would have about just totally abandoning the city is that it was their last stronghold. They had nowhere else to go outside the Fire Nation. I mean, they could have all left and went to the Fire Nation, and then at that point they would have had everybody with them, you know?
So. That's fair. Yeah, that's fair. There's not really anywhere for them to go, because in Republic, the United Republic, Republic City really is the most populated place.
Yeah, 100%.
Kavira tells Ryko to turn over his army and the Avatar, and to give Batar Jr. his location, and he will come in settled terms. Korra tells General Iroh that she's not surrendering. She doesn't care what Ryko agreed to. She ain't going out like this. And he tells her to get back to the city before Kavira realizes that she's there. Korra returns to the others, and she says that they should capture Batar Jr. He built the giant mecha tank.
Yeah.
It's a good call. This is the first good idea Korra's had in a minute, too.
Yeah, this is a good call. I like it.
They infiltrate his airship and kidnap him. Batar Jr. refuses to help once they have him. And Sue tries to talk to her son. She really tries to plead with him. And he tells her that Kuvara is his family now.
This is the last ditch effort in your desperate attempt to hold on to power. You're done. It's over. We've won. And Kuvara's my family. It's just like, man. Oh, God. It's rough.
I really don't like Batar Jr., but anyway.
Junior's whipped. He's whipped, all right?
It's not just he's whipped. He's not making a lot of sense a lot of time. It's just
It doesn't make sense, but he's also, literally, he's, like, all about Kavara, everything. Like, I don't know how long this was going on, but he cannot let go. Like, it's just, like, crazy. Like, how long has she been, like, planning this and trying to get him on her side from back when we met her in season 3, because this feels like super wild that he's this engrossed in her that he's like willing to give up everybody else.
Yeah, she's definitely indoctrinated him.
Yeah.
And you know, people do crazy things for love, so
100%.
Korra, however, does not care about Sue's tactics to try to get him over. Mm-mm. By using love and family.
She goes
incentive.
Into the Avatar state.
She's like, listen, I will make it my life's mission.
Yeah, it's good.
That you never see Kavira again. And this has him shook. This is suddenly a thing that she can take from him that he's willing to negotiate over. Meanwhile, on Air Temple Island, Batar Jr.'s airship arrives, and his men are just realizing that...
He's not here.
He's not there. Nope. Actually, his people, because there's a woman with them as well. They're a little confused. They don't understand where he is. Ryko's like, put Kavira on the phone. And they talk, and Batar Jr. breaks in the communication. Meanwhile, Kavira tries to find out where the radio communication is coming from. Batar Jr. tries to plead with her and says they can just leave the city. Just forget it. Let's go back to the Empire and live our lives together. Kavira agrees. And then she aims the weapon at their location and fires it.
What a tough situation. Like, attempts to murder the dude who's like given up his family and everything else, and everybody else included. But she just like, oh yeah, okay, I agree. Let's just go. Let's get out of here. And then it's like, you know what? I've come too far. I'm gonna get rid of him. And almost in the sense of like, if I get rid of him, then I won't have any loose ends.
I think she sees him as a weakness in this moment. This felt chilling to me.
Yeah.
It's really chilling because it would have been one thing. I think the first time I watched this, I walked away with a different sense of their conversation. I thought perhaps that Batar had given her a sort of a nod that he was willing to sacrifice himself. But it's very clear that that's not what's happening. That he is saying, let's just walk away. we don't have to do this. You're choosing to do this. We can leave and be together. And she tries to kill him.
Agreed. It's crazy.
It's really horrible. Raiko and Lin watch the destruction from Air Temple Island, and Lin immediately heads towards the explosion to check for survivors.
Whew, man. It's a what an episode. And that starts off the day of Colossus. So Bolin manages to hold up some of the rubble in the explosion so that everyone can escape. Good look to have a freaking earthbender and lava bender of Bolin's stature. I'm really glad you did it. And so as they're out, as soon as they're out of the wreckage, the battle begins. Kivara's army has scores of mecha tanks, and the giant mecha tank, obviously that she's in. Bolin says that they should abandon the city and come back later to fight Kivara, which is what we were just talking about. But Korra says she's not letting her take Republic City. She, you know, obviously Korra feels like this is a stronghold, and to take the city that would be like, you know, abandoning their strength. Varric notes that Kivara has destroyed the hummingbird suits, which is a good call. They got no way to kind of do that to go after her. But Asami says she has a few prototypes at her office. Korra and the other benders will fight using their skills, and Asami and Varric will get to the prototypes to get them ready. At the train station, people are panicking.
Legit,
but Wu has an idea. Wu's like, I got an idea. And he leaves Pema in charge, and Pema has the line. He's like, can you handle this crowd? She says, I raised Milo. If I can raise Milo, I can handle anything. She's not wrong. Milo then comes in with his own plan. Get him some paint and some balloons. He's going to take the balloons with the airbenders. They're going to glide over the big mecha tank, and they're going to drop it on the windshield of Kivara, where she can like not see. Kivara fires at them, but she misses, and they get above her and use the paint-filled balloons to drop it on the glass. Bolin uses lava bending to sink the tank's legs because, you know, there's no way to use metal bending or anything because it's made out of platinum. So he uses the lava bending to sink the legs, and then they use a metal rope to bind the robot or the mecha tank's feet. Korra uses water, and airbenders use air to destabilize the tank and knock it over before it falls. Kivara gets her footing and fires the weapon again.
This was a lot.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, hats off to Milo for having a great idea. This was a great idea.
I agree.
And the execution of it was pretty decent, considering that they were thinking on their feet. Mm-hmm. But this woman is just indiscriminately firing this weapon at this point. I mean, this was genuinely terrifying. She's totally fine with destroying Republic City.
Yeah, she doesn't care. She's just like, let me burn everything down and do it the way it needs to be done. I don't know why she wants to do that, because you would think she'd want to take the city in some sort of wholeness, so that she could have, like, you know, but you know, she's proven already that she's like unhinged at this point. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah, so definitely. She doesn't care about anything but winning.
Yes, and so at this point, many of the airbenders have been hurt. And Korra tells everyone to retreat to Asami's office. Kivara's weapon continues to destroy the city. Back at Asami's office, Julie and Varric are having trouble getting the hummingbird to work. They get word that the army is heading their way. Varric has an idea. He tells them to disconnect anything electrical, and he runs off. He's probably going to use the same thing that he used to get them through at the checkpoint. Upstairs, Sue sits at Batar Jr.'s bedside.
Why?
Because she's a mom. I mean, that's...
I mean, just, there's limits to... Whatever. Okay, sure.
I mean, I mean, yes, and you still want to be, like, there. I mean, like, I think she's a little too easy on him, but, like, you know, she's trying to bring him back into the fold. He apologizes and can't believe that, you know, Kivara tried to kill him. Sue accepts his apology. She says the rest of the family's going to need some work, though. Like, honestly... You're gonna have to work at that one, because they're all a little bit disturbed by how you turned on them. Rightfully so. Varric's plan is, in fact, to use the electromagnetic pulse and to take out the mecha suits. He starts telling Julie some weird story about childhood that he isn't able to finish. He's basically starting, and he fins off with like, oh, yeah, I took, you know, my what was it? It was a horse. What was it? A horse.
I don't remember this story at all because it was so nonsensical. He was basically trying to tell Julie some story about taking someone for granted. It had no purpose.
Yeah, it had no purpose. It was just him telling the story. But he was trying to get to what he feels about her, but he never got there, and she cut him off. And she's like, "Listen, we got a job to do." And basically, the electromagnetic pulse does nothing to Kavera's giant suit. Nothing. It doesn't move it. Nothing happens.
He takes out the other mecha suits though, which is cool.
Yeah, at least he got rid of them for sure. So, Batar Jr. tells everyone that the giant mecha tank is impossible to stop because it's powered by Spirit Vine. Oh, this would have been nice to know, Jr. This would have been nice to know ahead of time. And when she was, so there we go. Just then, Lin returns with none other than Hiroshi Sato. She pulled him out of jail to help. They love freeing these criminals. They just love them.
When it's convenient to them, the justice system means nothing.
Exactly. They're like, let's go. Let's get them. He tells them that they must act like an infection and get inside of the suit and infect the body. His plan is to use a saw to get into the suit. It's actually a good plan. I like this plan.
Yeah. No, he... Smart. Smart plan.
He didn't do in the Cabbage Man, you know, without some cunning and skill. He brought the Cabbage Man down all the way.
He brought Cabbage Corp down, not the Cabbage Man in particular.
I mean, the Cabbage Man did come out and say his cabbages, although he is not the original Cabbage Man, wouldn't we say that his son is still the Cabbage Man? I mean, he went
my
down.
Cabbage Corp.
Not my Cabbage Corp. He went down. No, yeah, so anyway, but Hiroshi's trying to turn over a new leaf, so he wants to help him, right? He's like trying to figure out how to go ahead and do something a little bit differently. So he tells them exactly what they need to do to be able to resolve the issue, which is to act like an infection. Get inside the body of this suit. Meanwhile, at the train station, Pema has begun singing to the crowd Air Nomad songs.
I guess this is how she kept Milo in line, right? I mean, I guess we have to assume that Pema kept Milo in line by singing to him.
That's what she said. Hey, that's what I mean. She kind of had them subdued. They were sitting there. They were sitting there. They complained near the end, but they had to have sat there for a while because they were.
Did
this
you
was happening
did
for
you notice
while.
Grandma Yin's face?
I did.
She looks so miserable. Get me out of here.
Can we go, please? Yeah, exactly. Wu then returns on the back of two giant badger moles. He's here with the badger moles. His idea is to have them tunnel out of the city, having them earthbend out of the city, right? So Kivera's people found the source of the magnetic pulse, and they head its way. Batar gives them the direction of how to shut down the suit from inside. As it heads their way, Korra and the other benders engage with the suit and slow it down. In the process, Tenzin is injured while trying to save Jinora. She shoots at Jinora and Tenzin saves Jinora. Thank God. Yes, we're glad. We needed that. Iki and Milo manage to save both of them. Milo struggles to keep his dad up. He's like falling to the ground. Iki catches Jinora. It's really a, you know, love these guys.
I love it. I loved every moment of this. It was just the true family spirit here. They just acted really quickly. Yep. And Iki saves Jinora easily.
Yep.
There's no struggle. And then, you know, Milo's tiny, so obviously lifting his dad's heavy behind is hard. But yeah. The way they didn't hesitate, they just got in there. Like Tenzin didn't hesitate to save Jinora, and then Iki and Milo didn't hesitate to save them both. It was beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, and to see, I mean, it was really beautiful, and it was like, wow, you're right. It happened so quick that I didn't even realize Tenzin was so badly hurt, right? Like, I was like, well, why is she catching Jenora? And then I realized that Milo was then saving his dad. I was like, wow, this is crazy. It happened so quick. It happened really fast. So I love it. They did not hesitate at all. So finally, they bring down the tank. They bring it down, her suit, everything falls using like earthbending, buildings, whole thing. But it's only for a moment. Kavera manages to get back standing up. And meanwhile, the evacuation is interrupted by Kavera's people. Wu offers himself up, singing a little song, and the Badger Moles appear to leave. They're like, oh, yeah.
looks like your Badger Moles left.
And he's like, you don't know what you're talking about. And then they come around, and they smash the guards in the mecha tanks and destroy them. And it's like, you know, Wu had a plan the whole time. Badger Moles love him and obviously love his singing. Say what you want about the Earth Kingdom monarchy. They do have special relationships with their pets.
Except for the queen, who hated all animals.
Hated all animals. It's true. Everyone except for the queen. So Hiroshi gets into a hummingbird, and Asami tells him that she loves him. Varric and Zhu Li have a very touching moment, too, when he offers her a ring and asks her if she will do the thing for the rest of their lives.
Zhu Li says yes. Beautiful. Except, no. She should have said no. Absolutely not. He has not proven himself worthy of Zhu Li at this point.
You say, no, you don't want to hear it for the rest of your life. You don't want to hear him saying, Zhu Li, do the thing. Like, that's it. That you want to hear that too much more?
No.
I hear you. Yes. Oh, man. So the battle with Kavera is raging on. It's all of Team Avatar against the giant tank while the hummingbirds approach. Because there are two of them, Kavera doesn't know which one to focus on. Korra uses ice to freeze the tank in place while Asami and her father attach to the tank. Hiroshi is almost done and getting it done, and he doesn't want to, you know, he's like, you know, Asami's like, we gotta get out of here because she's trying to swat him and smash him. And Hiroshi ejects Asami before Kavera smashes his hummingbird, killing him. The remaining members of Team Avatar, Mako, Bolin, Sue, and Lin, and Korra make it inside of the mecha tank. And right now, I know he's had a tumultuous ride. I know that there were moments where we were ready to give up on him. Good thing Asami did not, and that Lin went and got him. Let's pour one out for Hiroshi Sato.
Yes, yes. He deserves it. What a redemption arc.
He does. I agree. He does. He atoned.
He did. Well, Hiroshi, it was good to have you in, you know, books 1 and 4. Poor Asami, though. She now has no parents.
I know. I feel bad for Asami. Yeah. That was a rough one. That was a tough part of the episode. It's really
sad. I do have a little bit of a quabble at this point, and I think this is a little bit of a plot hole. The outside of the suit, it's well established as platinum. Mm-hmm. How does Kavera know where they are on the suit? How can she feel? We know she can feel the inside of the suit, but how does she know that they're getting inside the suit? Like, that part doesn't jive with me. I don't understand it.
I mean, I'm with you on that. I think the one thing I was thinking was that maybe the outside layer of the suit was platinum, but that the inside was metal, and that you couldn't get past that layer to do any bending. So that was what it was. That's the only thing I could come to, because you do have a valid point. Like, why they would even need to do this would make no sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that Lin establishes in the previous scene that the outside of the tank is platinum, so she can't bend it at all.
Yeah.
So then to have Kavera able to feel the hummingbirds land on her, it just doesn't sit right with me. But, you know, maybe you might be right. Maybe it's almost like a plating, right? Like the outside of the suit is platinum, but if you can get beyond the platinum, it's metal. I don't know. But I just wasn't crazy about this. Anyway, just a small. It's a small.
No,
detail.
It's a very good. It's a very good catch because it does. It's not really explained, so it is a very good catch. You know, so I'm with you. I'm following because I thought about it, but I was like, well, I just kind of like was like, oh, well, maybe it's the outside. But you're right. I mean, they say that very clearly. The joints are also platinum. You know what I mean? So it could be just something they didn't think about really well.
Yeah. So the final episode, the finale, yeah. A little sad going into it.
I know.
The last stand starts with all of the folks we just mentioned, Mako, Bo, Lin, Su, Lin, and Korra, inside of the giant mecha tank. Korra tells Su and Lin to disarm the weapon, and she tells Bo, Lin, and Mako to get to the engine room and power down the suit. Korra has plans for herself. She's going directly after Kavira.
And Sue's like, you sure? Because she kind of whooped your ass last time. You sure you want to do that? And she's like, yeah, no, not this time. I got it this time.
She's ready. Korra's ready.
I think so, too.
Bolin and Mako get into the engine room and immediately encounter guards that they fight with. And Lin and Su are also spotted immediately. Lin says that she will fight, and Sue's job is to disable the weapon. Mm. Su sends parts of the machine, because the inside is metal, into the weapon and appears to have disabled it by metal bending inside the arm. Mm-hmm. Kavira feels this, and she basically is like, well, it's useless now. She rips off the arm and sends it flying across the city. This is what I mean. Kavira does not care about the consequences of her actions. This thing, when it lands, could kill hundreds of people. She doesn't know that they're evacuating everyone. This woman is completely
She's ruthless. She does not care. And good thing that the Beifong sisters were like, let's bend some metal around ourselves so that we're attached to this arm. Because if not, she's going to throw us flying someplace too.
I actually thought Lin was a goner multiple times in this episode.
Yeah, for sure.
So just then, Korra arrives in the control room, and she and Kavira start to battle.
I was ready
for this. I was like, whoop her ass, Korra.
Yep.
At first, it seems like Kavira is going to win, but Korra gives a pretty good fight. Back in the engine room, Mako and Bolin have pulled the levers to shut the power down, but nothing is happening. Like, this is what they were told to do in order to stop the machine, but they do it and nothing happens. Bolin tells Mako that if they mess with the vines too much, the vines will explode. And Mako basically decides what he's going to do at that point. He tells Bolin to get the engineers out. He's going to zap the vines with electricity. Bolin is reluctant to leave his brother, but he does follow his directions. And Mako zaps the vines in the engine room, and it starts to explode. And then he's about to escape through the escape hatch, but he's shocked and passes out. Lucky for him, his brother came back for him and manages to reach him before the explosion. Korra and Kavira continue their fight in the control room. And when it explodes, the mecha tank is blasted in half. Korra pulls Kavira out of the wreckage, but Kavira is not ready to surrender. She takes off to run into the spirit wilds. Korra chases her. Apparently, the weapon landed in the spirit wilds. So Kavira gets into it and she fires the weapon at Korra. But then the vines are activated and they take over, and Kavira loses control of the weapon yet again.
But I thought that the weapon was dismantled when she threw the hand, and that there was no reason to, like, that she couldn't use it. That's what I was a little confused about.
Yeah, I wondered if what Lin and Su did actually just separated the weapon from the control room rather than actually disabled the weapon.
Gotcha. Because she does have to power something on the side of the arm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wondered if that was what Su actually did was just disconnect the control room from the arm so that Kavira could no longer control it.
Okay. Gotcha.
But understood. I also think this could have been explained better.
Yeah. No question. That's what I was thinking. But that makes sense to me because I was like, I was kind of stuck. I was like, how is she going to fire this? And then, she kind of ran right. She walked right into, you know, the line of sight of this weapon. It's crazy.
Yeah, and the weapon, so when she loses control of the weapon, it just starts to destroy everything around it. I mean, it's a really destructive super weapon.
Yeah.
To save Kuvira, Korra enters the Avatar state and propels a blast outward through the streets of Republic City. When it recedes, it creates a new spirit portal, exactly where the spirit wilds were.
What an amazing scene.
It was beautiful. Visually. I mean, it was just stunning. So first of all, the scene where the explosion is kind of blasting through the city and you see Tenzin and the kids take cover, Asami takes cover, that was really cool.
Yeah.
It was very terrifying because it looks just like a mushroom cloud. Yep. So it was like very scary, you know, this is the type of destruction that a weapon of mass destruction can create. When it recedes and then creates a new portal, it's what's so cool about this show is that we've seen these portals so many times that I knew immediately what was happening. And yeah. I was like, this is cool. There's going to be a new spirit portal right in the middle of Republic City. I could not help but think, like, I wish Aang could see this. Like, yeah. I wish that Korra could connect to Aang and be like, look what we did. This is really cool.
100%. 100%. Like, this is what I was thinking too. I was just like, wow, this is amazing. I have some thoughts about that, about the connection that I saved from the previous episode and this episode that I want to talk about with the spirit world. But I agree with you 100% on everything you just said, from the look of the explosion to seeing it come back up to a spirit portal, to wishing that Aang and Katara even, and all the people who played a part in Republic City, Zuko, could see what they actually were part of. It was beautiful. And
yeah.
And I was like, wow. You know, I did question why till later. I kind of and I sat with it because I was like, was it really worth it for Korra to stand in front of the blast to save Kuvira? And ultimately, I think I land on yes, that was the right call, because I thought about all the destruction. When she does it, she doesn't know where that blast is going to go. She doesn't know Tenzin's going to be able to get out of the way. She doesn't know that Mako and Balin are going to be safe. She doesn't know where Asami is. She's doing this, saving this person instinctually that was really trying to wipe out everybody in the whole entire city. And I wondered about that choice. But ultimately, I land on that's part of her growth. That's part of her growth path.
Yeah. The way I looked at it was, again, Korra unintentionally did something good here. Yeah. I don't think that Korra even thought for a second about it. Yeah. I think she just stepped in front of the blast. And
agreed.
The only way to do that would have been to save herself and Kuvira is to do it in the Avatar state. I don't think she'd really thought it through what the consequences of saving Kuvira might have been. And also, like, I think she would have been devastated if she found out later that having sent the blast to the city like that, she killed all her friends. But I think that it was just her instinct to save this person, which is really honorable when you think about it.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I can tell you who wouldn't have done it. Avatar Kyoshi would have been like,
no,
listen.
No. No, she it's quite possible that would have been the end, you know. that would have been where the story of Kuvira ended. It would have been done. Yeah. There may have even been just two Republic cities now. They would have been like that's it.
So everyone begins to look for Korra after this blast, but they can't find her because Korra's in the spirit world, as is Kuvira. Kuvira asks Korra why she saved her life, and Korra tells her, I see a lot of myself in you. Korra tells...
Yeah, and that's followed by a scene where we get that flashback to where she was when she saw herself when she was getting healed by the spirit water, to like seeing herself briefly and then seeing Kuvira across from her heading down into the spirit world. And it's almost like a mirror image, like they're looking at each other like they're the same person, which I think has a lot of tie-in. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like a lot mm-hmm. of tie-in.
Yeah. I mean, that imagery of them looking at each other, their spirit selves looking at each other, is really, it's beautiful, one. Like, it's drawn really mm-hmm. well. But in addition to that, it's just really impactful because we've been saying for this whole season, they're the same in a lot of ways. They're very similar.
Yeah. I think Kuvira is her like shadow to me, Kuvara is like the unevolved version of what Korra was, right?
Yeah.
Like where she was.
And she's her past self. Yeah.
Yeah, her past self. 100%.
Like, not as cruel. I don't think that Korra has ever been as cruel as Kuvira, but I think that she is as impulsive and single-minded and stubborn. And in the beginning, she believed that she was always right. Like, it was hard for her to take feedback. I think that this is what she could have come if she hadn't become if she hadn't gone through these trials.
Yeah, and Tenzin tells her that right in the remembrance episode, and then the spirits tell her that when they say you're trying to do the same thing that Kuvira is trying to do, you're trying to harness spirit power to fight her, but the reality of it is that that's not the way to win this. And I think like it's very clear that they're drawing this parallel, you know.
So Korra tells her that she understands her pain and suffering. She talks about how Kuvira was a little girl who was abandoned and tells her that she knows that she just wanted to create a place where the people of the Earth Kingdom would never feel vulnerable again. She brings Kuvira through the portal, and Kuvira immediately apologizes and surrenders and says that she will, you know, take responsibility for her actions. And Sue is like, yeah, you will.
Oh, you're going to pay. Oh, don't worry about that one. Yeah. Sue was having none of it. Sue was quick for justice. She was like, yeah.
Yeah, she's like, I have no problem punishing you. Don't worry about that, sweetheart.
Yeah.
The spirits also return to the city, sensing that the danger is gone now. The next scene is my least favorite scene from this entire series.
Come on, they're doing the thing.
Varric and Julie are doing the thing. They are getting married. It is also apparently the hottest event of the year. This is like Obama's birthday party. Everybody's there.
Except Larry David. Larry David did it. He got uninvited.
It is when you look at the audience, and I really wanted to look closer at it because I think I missed some people. Every major character we've met along the way is essentially all of the world dignitaries are there. It's a big event.
I got a question because I couldn't place it, and I wanted to say that I'm right. And even if some of the fans know, maybe you know right off the bat too. Was the lead instrumentalist in the band the dude who got his bending taken away by Amon?
Oh my goodness.
I think it is.
I don't know.
And I didn't have a chance to look it up, but the guy they focused in on him playing the saxophone or whatever, and I was like, holy crap, that looks like the band, right? Remember we were like, they're also a band? They were like, they're also a band or whatever, and like that looks like the band.
Oh, maybe it was. That would make a lot of sense. I didn't pay that close attention. I was more scanning the audience, but that would make sense. And it would be a nice callback. So I hope that's true. I'm going to look it up as soon as we finish here.
Yeah.
At the reception, Wu tells Mako and Korra that he's considering stepping down as king and abolishing the monarchy altogether.
So this is where they finally take, I feel like the show finally takes a stance on where they land a little bit, like hinting at it about rulers and monarchies. And they kind of lay out a little bit where what their thinking is. Because remember we said we don't really know where they land on some of this stuff. And it kind of is interesting to see them kind of like hint at where they're kind of going, you know, for the modern.
Mm-hmm.
Side of things.
Mm-hmm. And this is
Tano.
Extensive.
By the way, Tano in the band. Yes.
Oh, it is Tano. Tano. Okay.
It's Tano.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Tano is in the reception band. I thought so. I was like, I just looked it up while we were sitting. I was like, wow, that's amazing. I was like, because I saw him. I was like, wait, that's Tano. So, yeah, for sure. That's awesome.
Yeah, anyway. That's good for you for seeing that. I didn't even notice it.
Lots of callbacks. It was cool.
Korra promises to help Wu, and Mako tells Korra that he will always have her back, no matter what, despite all of the drama in the past, and they've been through so much together. He wants her to know that she can always count on him for support.
Mm.
Tenzin and Korra also talk, and he informs her that Raiko is going to expand the city rather than rebuild the downtown, which I thought was awesome.
Mm.
He tells Korra that she's done more in a few years than most avatars do in their lives. And Cora tells him that she understands now that she went through all of that suffering to make her a more compassionate and empathetic person.
So that even she could find compassion for someone like Kavara, who was going through what she was going through. I thought that was like so insightful. And I mean, Cora's growth from when we first met her to I'm the Avatar, you got to deal with it. I'm like, it's whipping up on the triads to basically being saying, hey, I needed to be more compassionate. What a journey, you know?
Yeah.
What a journey.
And this made me really think about how kind of evolved her thinking is, just because this is a thing that we struggle with all the time, understanding our enemies, understanding why people don't like us, don't hold the same position as us, disagree with us in a way in which would lead them to do things that we see as extreme. I don't always think that we have to make space for these people in our lives, but we can do better in combating some of what they're doing and saying if we try to understand where they're coming from.
Agreed. It reminds me of a story I read, and I'm paraphrasing. I don't know the exact story, but I'll just say this about Abraham Lincoln, where a lady was kind of like, he was giving a speech about, you know, making friends of your enemies and loving your enemies. And one of the people listening to the speech kind of was irritated with him and kind of heckled him a little bit, like, you know, no, we need to destroy our enemies. Like, why would we ever do that? We want to destroy people who want to destroy us. And his response was, well, if I've made my enemy my friend, haven't I destroyed my enemy? And I was like, I was always struck by that. It's like, wow, that's an evolved way to think about it. It's not always possible. I don't want to get it twisted. It's sometimes just to draw a boundary and move on is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can, like, it's like, if it's out there for you to do it, to like get past those things and almost not even have enemies, that's not have an enemy in that person. That's preferable. So I think like it's actually just a really cool way to look at it. You know?
Well, let's just even look back at Aang and Zuko. They yeah. wanted to make sure that everybody was included. That Aang wanted to make sure that the Fire Nation was still in the fold, even after they were defeated. Not that they were destroyed, but that they mm-hmm. could move forward. Mm-hmm. He wasn't trying to eliminate the Fire Nation. He was just trying to get the Fire Nation to stand down and end the war.
Mm-hmm.
That's really different than the type of warfare that we're used to seeing, which is essentially basically destroy everything. Wars don't always start that way with those intentions, but it often feels like that's how they end. So I really love this, because I don't always think that you need to suffer to be compassionate or to grow. But I like that Cora is doing here what Katara asked her to do, which was find meaning in her suffering.
Yeah.
So it's nice for her to call that out.
And they borrow from Buddhism there too, right? Like they take the Siddhartha story a little bit, because part of Siddhartha's story was that he was kind of isolated from the world and was a ruler and was royalty and never saw anybody sick and never saw any punishment and never saw any suffering. And that the thing that started him on his journey to becoming the Buddha was to sneak out of the palace and to see somebody who was sick. And it made him really think about suffering, and like he had never seen that. He'd never even seen a person sick before, so he didn't understand how that was even possible, or saw a poor person, and he saw suffering for the first time, and it started him on this journey of like trying to find enlightenment. And that's the whole story. So to for them to like kind of nod to that, as much as they've borrowed from, you know, the Tao Te Ching, the Buddhist text, a lot of Eastern philosophies, It was really cool to call back to that from the previous series in Atla to this one too. So I thought it was cool.
Mm-hmm. Korra's conversation with Tenzin is interrupted by Asami, and Korra asks her to sit with her for a while. Mm-hmm. They talk about their future plans. Like, what do you do now when you've essentially peaked at like 20 years old?
Mm-hmm. Word. It's a tough look.
What do you do? And Asami says that she could really use a vacation. You know, she's been through a lot.
Preach, sister, preach.
Cora says they should do it. Let's go on a vacation, just the two of us. And Asami tells her she's always wanted to visit the spirit world. The two of them decide to go, and they walk to the spirit portal together, holding hands. That is the end of the show, which I have to say, I've had my ups and downs of this show, but I do actually love how it ends. I thought this was beautiful.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I was so blown away because, you know, all right. So they don't really do all of the work to make it like Korra and Asami. Korra Asami, one of my favorite duos in all of the Atlaverse. How we get here and some of the reasoning why is not on the show creators. It was on the, from what I understand and all I've read, it was on the bias of the network, who really didn't want, who they were very clear that they wanted Asami and Korra to end up together, and the network was kind of backed away from that. And so that's why there's not a kiss. That's why there's not more building of the relationship. They just kind of hint at it and Easter egg here, and then you see the walk off. But I mean, I'm really interested to see how Avatar Studios evolves with covering, you know, I'm just going to say it. There's some other LGBTQ avatars, and it'd be really interesting to see how they cover this moving forward. I was really, this is one of the things that I loved so much about this show.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I like it too. And we should also note that the back end of this season didn't even air on Nickelodeon. They had relegated it to a web series only, which I think is like a true slap in the face to this entire universe, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I do understand some of the network's concerns about the unevenness of the show. There was some backlash amongst the fans from what I've read. And again, mm-hmm. everything that I've read about this show for the most part has been recently published. So it has this hindsight and this like context. I don't think at the time everyone quite understood what was going on. I think people just were like, oh, it must have poor ratings. And so that's why they put it as a web series. I don't understand why networks do this. If you commit to the final season, just run with the final season, you know, like just let it play out. But I can understand that they thought some of the themes were too controversial.
Yeah, and I think that Viacom was, they couldn't, it was very clear to me that the creators wanted to push the envelope. When you look at Amon and you look at the way they started, and then also, like, to me, this is just me. I remember finishing this, and one of the first things I text you when I first finished the series, because at the time when I first finished the series, we were still in, like, early on covering Atla, right? Like, so it was, like, not even, and I was like, oh, man, you're going to have to watch Korra. And we were, like, kind of getting through it. And I remember saying to you, I think this is one of the, for the time that they made it, this is perhaps one of the most progressive animated series that I've seen, I'm not saying that's out there, but that I had seen at the time. And I thought it was really cool. I thought they wanted to take some chances, and I think Viacom wasn't ready. I think Viacom would be more ready now, but I don't think they were ready then. And I think like that ultimately led to, oh, we're only going to give them one season. Oh, we're going to give them another season. Oh, we're going to give them this season. And I think that hurt the show's evenness overall, because they didn't confirm multiple seasons until they were already halfway through the series. You know?
So. Well, last laugh on Viacom, because at the end of the day, both Atla and Korra have had a revival due to streaming.
Exactly.
Which would never have happened when the show was relegated to, you know, the website. So this show, I think, does age quite well. It's not that old, so it's not, you know, we'll see how it ages in a few years. I think the main issues with the show are ones we've all talked about, which are, there are times where the writing feels uneven, the pacing feel. I felt like the end of the series, while I loved it, I wanted more time. I wanted to have some resolutions and goodbyes we didn't get to have. We don't get to see Iki, Jinora, and Milo again, really. Like, that. There's no conversation between them and Korra at the end. I really needed to have that. Now, I understand you don't want to write an episode that's all farewells. So Korra's just going from place to place to place. And she had the most important conversations, in my opinion, in some ways. But I would have preferred her talking to Bolin over Mako. I would have preferred if, like, Pema and the kids were present when she was talking to Tenzin. They're just some little... I would have loved to see her talk to Katara one more time. Like, what if Katara had had that conversation with her about how proud Aang would be to see what happened in Republic City. There were just some things where I was like, I need more. But I do think that her and Asami walking off together holding hands is a truly beautiful moment. And there was no one like, these two are worthy of each other. Agreed. They really are, in the way that they've dealt with each other with compassion and empathy most of their relationship, in the way that they support each other. It makes sense. Did they do the work to make it seem as romantic? No, but I would argue they didn't always do the work with Aang and Katara either.
Yeah, I agree with that. They didn't always do the work with Aang and Katara either, 110%. But one thing that I think, now that we can go back, because we didn't want to spoil anything, especially even in the last episode, when they have their reunion and both of them are really quiet, when Mako was like, well, why didn't you write us, right? And she says, I caught this time, and she's like, oh, I don't know. I just didn't, I didn't know what to say, right? And then Asami didn't say anything, and then the two of them kind of have like an argument. Well, they've been talking via correspondence for a while. So like, you don't get to come back after 3 years is more like, and say that stuff is more like an argument, kind of like, but I've been talking to you, like, kind of like they have a deeper relationship at this point. And what I read into that, and I'm reading a lot, I didn't do all this work, but I'm reading a lot into it, is that Bolin and Mako are both two people, though they're friends, that she used to date. She went on a date with Bolin, and she dated Mako in a serious relationship. Perhaps Asami is like, yeah, we're all friends, but maybe she was trying to sort out her feelings with Asami and didn't want to write them. That's where I landed on it. And it was like, yeah, I want to see where this goes, and I don't want to write them. They don't say that explicitly, but that would make sense as to why it was so awkward at the table when they got quiet.
Yeah. I'm going to give them a lot of runway on the Asami and Korra thing. I just am. Maybe that's bias, because I love Asami's character a lot. But I'm just going to give them a lot of runway. It works for me. Yeah.
From all the judgment that Korra had to like being in a relationship with her, like all the judgment she had of who Asami was, and then Asami, and then how they just, I don't know. I love it. I love it. I love the show. So I love that part of the show. That landed it for me. And maybe it's because I was so close to like not loving, like wanting to love the way that, like, okay, you know, I love that the kids come, you know, I love that Tenzin's here, you know, I love the grandkids, but again, not loving the way we got to Aang and Katara kissing in at the tea house, I was just like, what? So seeing it this way, I know I didn't love that they did didn't do all the work, but it still felt better than that one to me. I don't say better, it felt like I felt that a little bit more, you know what I mean?
So let's talk about another relationship, because I've been waiting this entire run to talk about this wedding. You remember that when I finished the series, I hadn't said anything to you about the series. And my first response was, they got married?
Yeah. That was hilarious. The funny part is that text came so out of context, because I didn't know you were talking about the show, and I was like, who? And you're like, can you tell me? And I was like, oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, that was funny. That, for sure. That, you were not happy.
No.
I mean, it doesn't make sense.
I'm still not happy. I'm just, Julie, come on. Why? Anyway, I don't want to spend too much time on it, because I just feel
you could
like...
you could write a whole piece.
I really could. I'm so, it wounded me so deeply that these two got married. I was big mad at the end. Yeah. And I don't even know why, because I don't even think that I cared that deeply about either of their characters the first time I watched this. As I watched a second time, Julie became a beloved character to me. But the first time I was just like, these are two minor characters. I don't believe they're getting married. I cannot believe that Julie would put up with Varric's nonsense. Boo. I'm out on it. Don't at me. Actually, you can at me. I'm going to leave you on red. Just like all the villains left Unalaq on red. I'm leaving y'all on red. Okay.
Is you know who coming? No, gotta get out of here. Oh, that's so good. It's one of my favorite parts too. But I think why it upsets you and why it upsets me is, if you really think about it, it's kind of like, you know, they knew they weren't going to get the kiss with Asami and Korra. So it, and the whole love story, full on love story. So they threw in a love story, like, to approximate like what we got with Aang and Katara in some ways. And if that's, you know, there's a lot of people that this caused whole arguments online. I've seen them recently about how that lands with Katara and Aang. And it's still arguments about how it lands with Asami and Korra, which people like have remade it where they actually do kiss in the, on the portal, on the way to Spirit Portal. And I think ultimately all the stuff we made jokes about and ran through about the Katara erasure, about, you know, yes, they let Julie like dip Varric and kiss him, but like all the abuse she took to then marry the person who was kind of like condescending and abusive to her the whole time. There's some blind spots here when it comes to relationships and how relationships work out for the women in this story. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel, you know, they got Toph, who, yeah, she has a lot of things with her. She's stubborn and all sorts of stuff. They got Toph out here with two baby daddies. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying anything's wrong with that. I'm just saying they're writing this stuff from a place. I don't know what I would suggest to these creators. 110% is the same thing I suggested to about Game of Thrones. Diversity in your writing room is essential. Diversity of thought. Like, I love that, and they do a very good job for the most part when it comes to a lot of the cultural aspects of respecting Asian culture. I from what I've read and what I understand, but there's some work that still that I would get some more diversity, and truly more diversity in the writing room would help all this.
I agree, and I also think the people who are still angry about Asami and Korra, it's because you frequently have characters who read as queer in television and movies, but are never explicitly queer. And I think that that is something that is a very fair thing to call out and to be angry about. It's very frustrating to only see parts of yourself reflected in media. 100%. I like this ending, but I do think it is missing the explicit part, or they a couple. I saw it that way, right? But it could also be read a different way, that they're just really good friends. So I can understand people's frustration about it for sure.
Yeah, me too. 110% I do. I understand the frustration.
It's intentionally written to be vague. So, and that's the frustrating part, I think, for people.
I think they're evolving, though. I think they're evolving on a lot of this stuff, and I think some of it is because they're getting more freedom. I don't know. Actually, I don't want to judge they're evolving. I think they're getting more freedom to express some of the things that I think that they were hinting at in the shows, because as you read that, like, not only in the standpoint of relationships and other things, but the comics, the novels, all the ancillary stuff, there's lots more. They push the envelope. They go further in a lot of ways, you know? So anyway.
Can I show my last point on Julie and Varric?
Yeah.
And then I'll let it die. And I'm going to get people adding me for this. Okay. They remind me of Josh Lyman and Donna Moss from The West Wing. And that relationship was also toxic. I'm leaving it there. The West Wing heads are going to be...
How are you going to do me like this? Because I see your tie-in. I totally see your tie-in. And it was a real problem for me. Like, when they got together, I was like, I wanted it and didn't want it all at the same time.
Exactly. I think all when at the Josh same time. And Donna got together, I was very happy about it. And I'm sorry for those of you who were spoiling The West Wing, but The West Wing's been off for ages. Like, we've had 2-3 presidential administrations since then. So I'm sorry. I can't spoil a show that's been out that long. I just...
If you don't want to hear anything else about The West Wing in the next go, skip ahead or skip back. But we're going to just go here for a second. Yeah.
So I wanted them to get together because Donna wanted it for so long. And we knew that Josh loved her, but he couldn't admit that he loves her, which is exactly the problem with Varric. But Josh treated Donna terribly and she deserved better. And that's it. That's really all I have to say about it. Julie deserved better.
100%. She even has like a last second glow up. Like she gets out of her assistant attire and everything. And she's like, yo, I'm coming in my regular clothes. I'm not wearing no Varric industry stuff. I was like, okay, Julie, do your thing. Do your thing.
Do the thing without
Varric. Do the thing. Yeah, exactly.
Without Varric.
Without Varric.
So why don't we just talk about a couple other things? And I want to talk about Avatar Studios very briefly before we end. Yeah. I think that would be fun to just talk about what stories we'd like to see. And so I just want to call out that I do not believe, having seen this finale episode 4 times, I do not believe that Mako and Bolin survive. They are protected by the best armor you can have, which is plot armor.
Yeah.
Do not believe that they survive.
Yeah.
There's multiple people who I'm like, they would have been dead. Tenzin is definitely one of them. Tenzin gets sideswiped by the super weapon and walks away from that. But the Mako Bolin thing is just too far. Mako gets shocked by an electric current and then the thing explodes while they're escaping it. There's no way.
Yeah, it's true. It's really rough. It's really rough.
There's no way.
It's really rough.
Also, where are Batara Sr. and Huan?
Do we care? I mean, honestly, I'm good on. I mean, Batara Sr. like almost got us killed just escaping after we did all this work and we're stealth. The Huan is, you know, he's pretty, he doesn't do any fighting. He's a bad sculptor.
He's an artist.
Yeah, he is. But he was there. He was there at the wedding.
Oh, he was? Okay.
Yeah, he dances. He dances through in the front of the thing. Because at first I thought he was the one playing the sax, which is why I realized that it was our boy from back in season one. That it was Tano, because I thought it was him. And then I said, oh, he doesn't have any color hair. And then like he danced through the screen. I was like, oh, there he goes.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. They made it. That's all.
Like, they made it.
Did Sue they made it, but I mean, the rest of her family.
Honestly, they could have had a wedding and a funeral, and I would have been okay. Sorry, we could pour one out for Batara Senior.
You know, poor Batara Senior.
Yeah.
So let's just talk. Like, okay, so this is the conclusion of our coverage of this universe for now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what stories we would like to see Avatar Studios cover.
Okay. So part of what I'd like to see Avatar Studios cover is going to talk about what I really like, what I think was planted in this that I didn't see until my multiple rewatches this time. In the episode with Zaheer, where she goes back in and she expresses she can't go back into the spirit world because she's experiencing a block. And he says, stay with it and go through. And then she ends up back in the spirit world. And she says, Rava. And Rava says, I'm so glad that you're back. And Rava says, I've always been with you. I feel like they opened the door that Korra could just have an extreme block that has not allowed her to reconnect back to her past lives. If that is the case, there is a tiny door open for a plot of Korra's journey back to reconnecting with her previous lives or the next Avatar connecting with their previous lives. And I would like to see that.
I would love to see that. I think that's... Yeah. I definitely think they should clean up the next Avatar should definitely be able to connect with their previous lives.
Yeah.
I think you're right. They may have opened a door... And perhaps that Avatar will be able to connect with Korra, and Korra can help them understand that she had a block that was perhaps created by trauma, in addition to having been created by Rava's spirit being almost destroyed. Yeah. I like it. I think for me, what I really like to see, and I know this is covered in the Korra comics, but I'd like to see what happens next in terms of the Fire Nation and the Earth Kingdom. Are they both going to be democracies? I would love to see what happens if the Fire Nation goes the same way and decides to be a democracy. And that doesn't leave out the Water Tribes either. Now, I know the Water Tribes have a little bit more democracy because you're elected chieftain of the Southern Water Tribe. But that doesn't appear to be the case in the Northern Water Tribe. So I would just like to see how things play out with the various governments, because that is one of the most compelling parts of the show, how complex government and leadership can really be. Yeah. I also just have some lingering questions that I would like to see answered. And some of these may be answered in some of the comics that I haven't read yet. But I need to know more about Toph's, you know, kids and who their fathers are. I'd also just love to know what Toph did in the time that she was estranged from her family, or separated from her family, I should say, because her and Sue had made up and had left Republic City. I kind of want to see Toph in the swamp. How did she get there? Why did she go there? Like, tell me more. That doesn't have to be like a full series. It doesn't even need to be a full episode. They could answer some of those questions in passing, but I'd love the answer to that question. For sure. And for me, what I really want to see is a Janora Ikki Milo spinoff.
Man, I'm with you. That was just about to go there. I would love, and throwing Kai in there too. Throw Kai in there. I would like to see that. That'd be dope.
Yeah, I would be very much in favor of just seeing more of Janora's spiritual development. Janora, I think, has the capacity to become a guru.
Yep.
And so I would love to see... We've been introduced to gurus before on the show. I'd love to see her spiritual path grow more.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I would love to see that. I'd actually like for them to go into the time period of the original Team Avatar, where they're adults, but they're not quite to the point where Aang is passing. Like, all that little time period in Republic City when they're adults. I'd like to see what happens to Sokka, so I can hear why, like, close to the end, why he ends up, like, why they end up going to lock up, you know, the Zaheer and all of his friends. Like, what happens there? I'd like to see that little time period where Team Avatar are the established, like, kind of, like, elders in the world. They're no longer kids, and see like what happened there. Like, there's things that I think would answer that about with Toph, and all that stuff would get answered there. So I'd love to see that series.
Yeah, and what about the Kyoshi Warriors and Suki? I would just Ty Lee. I think there's more content here to fill in the gaps, and I'd love to see them explore or at least answer some of these questions in the future. There's a lot of stories that can be told about this world. We haven't spent any time in the Fire Nation since the original series, so it'd be wonderful to see what's really going on there as
well.
Yeah,
I'm really interested in seeing... I know it's not Avatar Studios, but I'm really interested in seeing the live action. I want to see what they do with it. I want to see what happens.
I'm very... So I... You know, the creators are no longer part of that project, which is concerning. But I will say this. Upon seeing the show Shadow and Bone, I got hyped about what Netflix can do with the special effects for a live action series. So I'm mostly going to look to this live action series to just have better effects than the movie that we do not name.
What movie? There was a movie?
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
we don't discuss it. It never happened. Precisely.
Oh my gosh.
So that's what I'd love to see. This has been a wonderful journey through both of these shows. The comics were also good. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Obviously, I always enjoy talking to you about these stories. I'm really attached to these characters in ways that I wasn't expecting to be.
Yeah, me too.
So it's just been, it's been really dope.
It's been absolutely amazing. And it's opened me up to other content that we haven't even covered. Like, I read both Kyoshi novels in a matter of a month, you know, just like I know that they came out further apart, but I just was like, oh, I'm going to read the first one. And then the second one dropped really close to when I started the second one. I was like, I'm going to read the second one. And it was like, It was great. So yeah, I mean, that plus like all the comic stuff, plus all the conversations we've had with all of you, all of the feedback, all of the stuff we talk about on Facebook, you know, and it's also interesting because certain moments in life I'll be sitting there and I'll like chat to you about like, you know, stuff, something that a character said that like is applicable to our own lives or whatever. We'll like talk about it. And it's like it's become a meaningful part. Similar to like, you know, we spoiled Game of Thrones a couple of times because we love Game of Thrones, but it's become as important in the kind of like lexicon of fiction I love as that show was. You know what I mean? For me.
Yeah. So. I mean, I would totally agree with that. I've spent more time thinking about this world than I've spent thinking about any of the other worlds that we cover, really, to be honest. And I was really missing Game of Thrones. We used to spend endless hours theorizing about Game of Thrones. And this is not that type of show. It's mm-hmm. You don't need to spend endless hours theorizing. But I love the characters just as much. I'm just deeply invested in their stories as much as I was in the Game of Thrones characters who I loved. So I really appreciate the story. I'm very grateful to all the people who have been telling me over the years to watch it. Because I do like animated series, but I've always leaned towards more of the comedy types. So this was a nice, this was something that I probably wouldn't have watched if people hadn't stayed on me. So if you have more content to recommend, just, you know, I'll get there eventually. Just keep pushing because I'm grateful to everyone who recommended it. And honestly, this was like a perfect, these series were perfect to watch during the pandemic. They are both heavy at times, but also hopeful. And I truly appreciate that though the worlds are complicated and feel sometimes even more complicated than ours, that there's always hope. Hope always, like Rava, hope is always mm-hmm. kind of just there. We just need to access it. So thank you to everyone for joining us on this. It's been a real experience that I deeply appreciate.
100%. Yep. And you know, to quote my guy, the one and only Iroh, especially when you just said what you said about the pandemic and what this has been as like a kind of like something that was like a light and a guiding place and you could go through all this stuff and deal with it. Sometimes life is like a dark tunnel. You can't always see the light at the end of the tunnel. But if you just keep moving, you'll come to a better place. And I wish that for everyone listening. It has been wonderful to experience this with you all. And we will see you next time with the next show that we cover. We're going to take a little break. This is the end of this season. And we will be back soon with an announcement about what we're covering next. Till next time.
Bye, everyone.